we are all part of this. If we just expect that, oh, well, someone in Washington is going to come up with a law that's going to protect us all from AI, that's not going to work. I think everybody should feel they are accountable for what's happening and how they use the technology, how they develop the technology. I think it's really important everybody understands the risk associated with it.
First, thank you for coming and listening to the RH podcast. We talk about business, we talk about software, we talk about technology. One last thing, if you can share this podcast with anyone you know on Facebook, on Instagram, on Snapchat, on Twitter, it really helps bring people to the podcast. We don't make any money from this, so if you can do that for us, we'd really appreciate it. Now, let's move on and listen to our next guest. Hello, how are you?
Hello. I'm good, thanks.
Good. So this is Kate Puesh, and apart from being very experienced in the industry, she is a director of AI engineering at Axon. She's been at Microsoft for many years as engineering manager, so guiding and leading on the other engineers towards their goals as an architect, hands-on building systems for many years at Microsoft. And she's going to talk to us a little bit about AI, her understanding of it, how she thinks it's going to affect humanity, the market, how people work. And it would be great to learn from her today. So thank you for taking the time and joining us.
Sure. I'm glad to be here.
Fantastic. So first thing I want to ask is, what's your day-to-day like? So what does a director AI engineering do?
Okay. What do I do every day? Well, I do something I really like, actually. I do solve problems and I remove barriers from people. I try to empower people, give them the tool they need to be successful and to build good things. So that's okay. A lot of problem solving in all kinds of domains. It can be a technical problem. It can be a legal problem. It can be an ethical problem. So I help people to find solutions and I give them the right contact and the right materials and funds so that they can build good things for the company.
Do you have a way of sort of, when a person comes to you for a problem, regardless of sort of the subject matter, mm-hmm. do you have a way or a step-by-step process of sort of processing what they need and what kinds of things you might be able to provide them, or if you want to push them in one direction or another? So what's your ethos on that?
Yeah, great question. You know, I really like the Socratic approach. I like to ask questions to help people find solutions rather than prescribing. I think that's not really useful when you just give a solution to someone. Actually, they don't get much value and they're going to come back with another question. So I try to ask good questions, point them in the right direction, but I like to let people find solutions themselves.
Do you consider yourself more of a people person or more of a, I wouldn't say a tech person, but a person who is more interested in things and how those things work? Because it'd be interesting to see how you came to where you are.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I don't consider myself like a big extrovert. I'm fairly introvert and shy. But at the same time, I have a lot of empathy. And I think I can understand a lot of different people. What I really enjoy in my work right now is I'm working with a lot of different cultures. And I work with people in different countries, in Asia, in Europe, and in the US, in Canada. And they all think very differently. And that's great. I love to be exposed to that, all this different way of seeing problems. I think that makes me much smarter. I feel I'm really lucky.
Oh, that's fantastic. So do you feel like people from different places approach problems differently? And do they approach tech problems differently from different places? I don't know how that would be possible, but is that a thing?
I mean, every person is different.
Right.
But there are cultural trends and just in the way people communicate or what they will care about first when they look at a problem. Yeah, there are cultural things. Mm-hmm. I think if you ask, for example, a French person, French people are much more direct than American people. When I arrived here, I had to learn to say everything is awesome and that's great that, you know, this coffee is wonderful. Or French person, like if I say to my parents in French, "Oh, mom, your coffee is wonderful," she would be like, "What's going on?" It's just coffee, Kate. Anyway, yeah, I think for American people, you need to show them the North Star and tell them that's what we are building, that's where we are going. Why? For French people, you need to talk from the get-go about the risks and how you are going to handle that, and they are much more They have a different approach, I think. So there are cultural differences still, even so very personal, unique.
Right. Do you think there's a leadership style that it's better, or you feel like, you know, it's sort of very much about the culture? Like, do you think that one produces more results than the other?
No, I don't think so.
No?
I think a good leader is able to see the value of diversity and combining different way of thinking and approaching problems. So I think what's working best is combining a person from each culture together, and they challenge each other. They find the right path this way.
If you think about both of those that you identified, right? One is putting forward something that's big and positive, and pushing people towards that. And I think that can create a lot of momentum. Mm-hmm. But then I think with the example you just gave on the other side, where it's very realistic, like here are all the 7 things that might go wrong and let's attack them individually. Mm-hmm. That's more realistic, but it could also be something that makes you less willing to do something because you're like, oh, I have all these challenges ahead. Mm-hmm. So I would almost assume for one side, you would have to sort of bring them down to earth. And then from the other side, you have to show them the sky in a way.
Yeah.
Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about how you got to this position as a person that you identified as someone who is a little bit introverted, now having to sort of all day talk to people and give them your energy. I know that you started off as sort of like an intern, but even before that, what made you interested in technology?
Okay, great question. What made me interested in technology, I think, is that nobody in my family really was. They were all artists, and I think it's kind of natural to want to go beyond what your parents are already giving you. I wanted to explore something new, and so I think that's how I got interested when I was young. I also realized that there was a huge potential. I was amazed when I built my first website. I think I was 13 or something, or 14. And I was amazed at how much you could build with nothing. You did not need a lab or anything like that to make experiments. You can just do everything from one computer. That's an endless world of possibilities. So I loved that when I got into technology.
But I'm sure you were quite good at other things. So why did you commit to this as your how you were going to contribute to society?
Yeah, great question. I used to love to write. I still do, but I don't have enough time right now. And that's a shame. I should go back to doing that more. Anyway, I was really debating, when I was young, whether I should go and do some literature study or go into the tech world.
Yeah.
And I decided to go in tech because I thought, well, I don't know, for whatever is artistic, if you are constrained by having to gain your paycheck, it's going to constrain myself too much in my art, in what I write and in what I compose or paint or whatever. If I have to leave out of it, I will have to think about, what people will like? What do I have to put in the book so that people buy it? And so I thought that that's not going to work for me. I want to write whatever I want and say whatever I want, and I will contribute to the world and get a paycheck a different way. And I was also really, really curious about science anyway. Mm-hmm. Another aspect is I thought that, well, I can write and learn about literature by myself. For science, I need a teacher. So that was another reason.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. So if we talk about what you ended up doing when you got into Microsoft eventually, where I think Microsoft's a huge company and there's lots of opportunity for a lot of things you could do within the tech world. But you decided to commit yourself more to cloud architecture at Microsoft, and speech and language, when it wasn't cool, now it's all over the place. But you did that at Microsoft and decided to go in that direction. I'm not sure if you did it before and always were interested in it, because it sort of is a derivative of being a person who is interested in writing. But being a person who is interested in learning writing and then doing speech and language, and is a kind of, it sounds the same, but it's very different from a practical point of view. So even committing yourself in that direction is a whole thing. So how did you decide to go in that space at Microsoft?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I think it would be too easy if I could just drive my life, saying, I want to go into Microsoft. I want to go work in speech and language. No, the way the world works is you get opportunity, you take them or not. And so I did not decide, you know, after I graduated with my master's, I'm going to go for Microsoft. Actually, I applied to several companies, and my two of my friends, you know, there is a little bit of chance and fate in that. That's what I want to say. I did not drive the whole way. I just tried to make the right decisions based on my principles. And so I followed two friends in Microsoft, and I met that my first manager, who was a great, great person. And because that guy was so great, I decided, yeah, I want to be in that team. That's how I started. And that's how I learned to program for real, working on the back end of Outlook. There was no AI at all there, but I think it's good. I did a few years of just hardcore programming before jumping into science, because this was a very good team with a very high technical bar, and I like that. So I stayed a while because I thought, well, I'm learning something here. Like when I was a researcher in Montreal, I had never programmed before out of the academic context. And definitely that was a blocker. And I felt when I worked for the first time in a professional team with a high technical bar that I was learning something valuable for my ultimate goal, which was to go back to AI and work on, you know, state-of-the-art AI projects. Yeah, so I learned for a while. And when I felt, okay, I'm good enough now, I need to move, I've learned enough from my mentors, I contacted the one manager in cognitive services, which is a applied science department for speech. And I said, well, do you think there is value in having top-notch engineers in your science team? And he said, yeah, absolutely. You know, and so I came in this speech and language team, and I was the first engineer of the first engineering team there. And yeah, that was a great time. I had a lot of fun. I built a large-scale platform for experimentation there. And I worked weekends and long hours, but I did not care. That was wonderful. I was building something new from scratch, and I could see how it transformed the way research was conducted. So it was really motivating.
Right.
And after a while, I started mentoring a few people. My platform was now stable, and it was maintained by junior engineers. So I felt it was a good time for me to move and, you know, let my platform live without me. It did not need me anymore, so I moved to another team.
But before you go on to the other team, could we talk a little about the technical details of sort of what you build? Is that something we can talk about? General architecture of sort of what you build, general architecture.
I can talk a little bit about it.
Like, yeah.
The idea was to scale up our data prep pipeline. That was the main idea. We wanted to work with much, much more data. And so I had to basically build a large-scale compute cluster to process much higher volume of data.
Right.
The ultimate goal was to multiply the amount of data we were able to process by 10x. So the challenges there were around multi-threading, how you parallelize stuff, how you handle partial failures, how you do restart, how you auto-scale your cluster, how you optimize the costs, all these things.
Were you working on every single one of those? That sounds like a lot. So were you working on every single one of those things? And how long would you do that project for?
Oh, gosh. Maybe two, 3 years.
2, 3 years just to get it started?
Well, no, it was started after, I would say, 6 to 9 months. But then
6 to 9 months and then maintained.
Yeah, yeah. Then you maintain, you add new features and so on.
Right. Okay. And from there, you were able to move out of the project, had more junior engineers. Mm-hmm. Maintain this this monolith of an endeavor, and then you moved into.
Yeah, I moved back into office, and I managed my first team. It was a team of talented engineers working on building privacy-preserving pipelines for AI in Office 365. So there, I learned a lot about privacy and privacy-preserving techniques, like how you can build data set, manipulate data with care. For Microsoft, privacy is very, very important. That's a big selling point for them to say they are compliant. And so they care a lot about it, which is a good thing. And so I learned a lot about privacy preserving techniques, things like that. Plus, I learned to be a manager. I learned to run a team.
How long did you run that team for?
A bit more than a year.
More than a year. So I think here now we can maybe come to sort of the meat of it, which is AI. Mm-hmm. And some of your thoughts about AI, so what things that are going on. So can we just start off talking a little bit about AI, what it is, and then talk a little bit about how you think it's going to change things and risks and also advantages that you think the market is going to have with these new ways of interacting with machines.
Right. I think what you just said is really important. The AI is going to really change how we interact with software and machines in general in the upcoming 10 years. It's going to be a total transformation, just like the smartphone changed our world or the internet. I think the transformation we are going to observe during the upcoming 10, 15 years is going to be that big. And I'm at the same time looking forward and at the same time scared. So AI is just like the nuclear technology. It can take us to Mars, it can save civilization, but it can also kill us all, I think. So we have to be really careful.
All of us? What if we go to Mars?
Yeah, maybe we need to escape faster on Mars.
We need to escape, yeah.
So yeah, the main reason why I wanted to talk with you was other people get my voice heard is because I think it's important that we put on the right guide rails and that we are all part of this. If we just expect that, oh, well, someone in Washington is going to come up with a law that's going to protect us all from AI, that's not going to work. I think everybody should feel they are accountable for what's happening and how they use the technology, how they develop the technology. I think it's really important everybody understands the risk associated with it. And so right. That's why I wanted to chat about. So I think a lot of people have been talking about more of the long-term risks. I've heard, you know, Elon Musk, Intel, and so on have been talking about the risk of AI just taking over the world, which is a fair risk, I think. But there are shorter-term risks, which actually there are things already happening, like the loss of authenticity. Like you put your finger on it last time we talked. There is this thing that's mm-hmm. really worrying me, not about the future, about now. And after our conversation, I was like, yeah, he just put his finger right on the world to characterize this. Like that's authenticity, the loss of authenticity of our world and how the reality we see on our screen is disconnected from the actual world.
Let's talk a little bit about what you consider AI to be, just because for people who don't know much about, I think you can definitely, for all kinds mm-hmm. of reasons, really give what it really is like. And it's actually quite hard to define, but a lot of people think that AI or see AI as this sort of pseudo amorphous mm-hmm. thing that they know that it can change the copy that you ask it to change or something. And that's how mm-hmm. they see it. But for someone like yourself, because you work with tech so much, the fact that there is a system that can do that, I think insinuates such a high amount of power that it's so hard to translate like what it means for you to have something that can do that. I'd love for you to give it a try. It's hard even for me to ask the question, but you know, if you don't mind, hopefully you'll do it better than I can.
Okay, I'll try. I think an AI system is a digital brain that can learn from data and its exposure to the world, just like a human baby does. So, you know, when you have a first human baby, you give him toys so that they learn to handle things in their hand, and then they learn by mistake, right? They start to walk, they try, then fall, and they try again. And by trying and trying and trying, they learn. And the AI system is pretty much like that. It's a digital brain. So it's a set of connections between neurons. Digital neurons are being shaped by the data you feed it. So at first, when you take an AI neural network, an AI system, it's blank. It's just a neutral set. It's random, basically. It's completely random. You give it a stimulus, and the output is going to be a random. But what you do is that you teach it like a baby to react properly to each input. And so whenever the AI system is fed information, it outputs something. If it's correct, you say, yeah, great, that's correct. If it's off, you say, well, you need to adjust. And you tell the system how to adjust, and the digital brain is going to learn from that correction. And over time, it will be able to output the right thing.
Right.
Does that make any sense? That was hard.
Yes, it does. It's tough. So we have that sort of definition. It's basically a digital brain. I think that is a very, very accurate description. And now we want to sort of take that in, move forward with, okay, we have these digital brains. what makes it so risky to have these digital brains? I think that some of the risks are self-evident in that, okay, you know, you have the non-uniqueness of the ability to learn in the market, which now you sort of mitigate that against cost and mitigate that against scalability, but it's and sort of assume there's an improvement in that over time as more capital is poured into it. As that happens, why is that risky, and what makes you concerned about that?
Yeah, so that's great question. So that's the crux of the problem. One thing that always fascinated me about AIs is that they are not only spitting out what they have seen before, they are also extrapolating, just like we do, right? So it's not just they have learned, they have seen an example before and they are just spitting that out. No, they are able to extrapolate. When you had just narrow AI systems on the market, like what we call narrow AI is an AI which has a small input space and small output space, like an AI that learned to play chess. It can only do that. It cannot drive your Tesla. Like you have autopilot, it cannot play chess. Like these are narrow AI. Now we have more broader AI systems who can do much more because they are just much, much bigger. We have the compute power to do that now. And what's concerning about them is that if you compare them to the brain, they are able to process information much, much faster. Like, if you think about it, ChatGPT has read all of Wikipedia, has consumed all of the written content of the internet. If you and I were trying to do that, well, good luck, you know, try and read all Wikipedia.
Yeah. It'll take me longer than an evening. Yeah, that's exactly. For sure.
So this AI, even so they learn similarly to humans by trial and error, they internally, they are very different. So they might seem human because we have tailored their input and output to be very similar to what we are familiar with, because that's how we interact with them. But internally, they work very differently. They have far less connections. That's interesting. But in our brain, we have much more connections between neurons than there is even in ChatGPT. But they consume information. They process information much, much faster.
So you said they have far less connections than the amount of connections we have in a human brain. Is that what you said? You just said?
Yeah.
Okay. But they just have to process information faster. And that's where the power comes from. Okay, got it.
And so, well, that's a new form of intelligence, which might just be smarter than us.
And there's more power per unit neuron, essentially.
Yeah.
So there's an improvement in quality of neuron. Digital neurons are improvement in quality of neuron, is what you're saying. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, our brain does not use... Yeah, that's correct. Our brain does not use a lot of compute power. These big neural networks use a lot of power when they learn, but they learn very, very fast. And maybe their way of building connections is faster than us. So that being said, I think there is danger because they are very smart. But I also think that there is a thing very specific to human intelligence, which is the ability to proactively do something and to decide to do something. There is a power of will. I think AI do not yet have that. So that's why I don't think ChatGPT is going to take over the world tomorrow or even next year, because it still needs to be prompted, right? When you woke up this morning or when you send me an email saying, Kate, do you want to do this podcast? Nobody prompted you to do that. You just decided to do it. So the AI we have, I think, have no power of will. But still, they are impressive and they are definitely able to process information and find answers faster than us.
Okay. Is will the only issue?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a line that needs to be drawn? Is that the line that needs to be drawn? Or is that the only that you're concerned about?
No.
Or is this a milieu of things? No. Okay, go ahead. Because you talked earlier about like the small things that are happening currently. But please go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for your question. I think there is this long-term risk that a lot of people are debating about, okay, is AI a danger for humanity? Is it going to take over the world? But as I mentioned earlier, AI is just like nuclear power. Nuclear power in itself is not a bad thing. It does not have any will, right? But used by the wrong people, it can be very destructive. So I think AI is the same way, is a very powerful tool. I don't know if you remember the scandal of Cambridge Analytica. Do you remember that? Have you heard of it?
Yes, I do remember. That
was in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
That was before generative AI and ChatGPT was available broadly, right? we have elections coming up. There are tools online for anyone to create deepfake videos. It's a very lucrative business. So there are tools being built everywhere and sold for creating fake content and fake videos. And so, you know, when we are just months away from an election, it's kind of scary. So that's one thing that's really worrying me. The fact that it becomes now really easy to manipulate information. You know, we cannot trust anymore multimedia content, pictures and videos. You cannot know whether it's authentic or not. So I think we urgently need tools and legislations to preserve the authenticity of our information.
I think that's quite the alarm. And I think that's very fair to say. And I think it's a very fair concern. So one of the things you said that was interesting is like almost like nuclear energy. And what we ended up doing with nuclear energy is there's two things that happen. Simultaneously, it was used. And if you think of humanity as sort of a collective unit, especially with something like this, where the thing about nuclear energy is that you use it once and you get the point, right? And you decide, okay, maybe this isn't. But with something like AI, where if you can get to the point where it has a nuclear effect, because of the arena that it plays in, you can't really roll it back. It's not a rollbackable thing. So that's one issue that you brought up. The second issue is this concept of authenticity with manipulation of human perception with using digital media. And what that also does is create an obstruction with collective decision-making regarding anything that we need to have a consensus on that affects us, right? And then we could have consensus on, but we don't because we're misinformed. So it's almost like it has the potential to attack on multiple directions as long as we have this network that is global, what would you call it, nervous system that is the internet, right? So there's this short-term and long-term thing. And there's so many problems you've sort of brought up. So I'm trying to sort of create like, a narrative around it. But I guess the first thing is, I want to say, how do we actually get an idea of it being like, how do we create something more authentic, right? But that's not even the problem, because I think that's something that we will do or is something we should do. But how do we get people to understand that this is something that needs to be done quickly, right? Before they're misinformed in the idea that it isn't. Does that make sense?
Right.
Because we will be misinformed before we need to inform ourselves on how important authenticity is, right? So does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's a tough challenge. That's why I'm trying to raise a red flag here, saying, well, we need to do something about authenticity of content. So the solution is going to be multifaceted as always. So it's going to be a combination of legislation, thoughtful leadership, and just accountability. Like, I think if you just wait for a law to be passed before acting in an ethical way, then we are doomed, right? I think. One thing I really appreciate about the current company I'm working with is that they have this principle called ethics by design, where whenever we build a AI system, we try to consider several ethical dimensions before going into building. And so you have to think about bias, you have to think about privacy, you have to think about the risk of causing harm, whether it's physical or psychological. And I see that that's becoming a trend in the industry. You know, there are thoughtful leaders out there. So there are good people pushing AI in the right direction. But that's why we're not doomed. There are a lot of good, thoughtful leaders pushing their teams to ask themselves the right questions before building something. So that's a powerful force as well. And all this work is being done ahead of any legislation. Today, there is no legislation telling you have to build a responsible AI system, you have to test your system for bias, you have to think about your system taking over or talking people into committing bad things.
Right.
But people do it because they are educated and principled, and so they do the right thing. And the more we can spread the word and get the developer and scientific community on board, I think that's the real solution more than legislation.
Fair enough. So how do we, and I think you mentioned this before, and I think this is great because, it happens faster than it's sort of like a grassroots perspective. So how do you empower and scale that mentality? this idea of ethics in engineering, mm-hmm. it's actually really, it's interesting because like they have it in law. And so to have that in engineering is almost like it's something you should, it's supposed to come into classes, right? Like we, I think people who build systems now have the power, so much power mm-hmm. that you do need to say, hey, can you do something that is net positive always? Or could you take that into consideration all the time? It's actually quite interesting. I think it's going to change the way we do education mm-hmm. for this, so the engineering sector, right? Because it's almost in a way, the way things used to be, in order for you to have, you first have to build it, then you had someone to allow people to have access to it. But now both those things are machines in and of themselves, both the distribution and the product the product is a distribution network sometimes, mm-hmm. right? Like that's what Facebook is. And that's literally what Google is. The product is a distribution network. It's almost like there's an assumption of that always when you build things moving forward. And so you would have to have some sort of an idea of like, what are you distributing? Mm-hmm. And you make sure that it's net positive and consider all the angles. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So how do you, and especially with AI, it's going to make it even more high powered. So what are the things to consider then when you are building these systems? One way to say it is, what do you not do when you're building AI systems?
Yeah, you don't test in production. So, you know.
that's fair.
These systems are so powerful now that you need to think about the ethical risks from the get-go. And you need to think about the impact you will have on society from the get-go. So you do a full ethical study before going and deploying your product. I think, so you need to test your product for bias. You need to, so that requires an effort, but you need to collect a data set, which is representative of the diversity of the users you're going to provide the product to. You also need to test your product for just basic safety. So that's a new thing that's emerging, and I'm really happy about it.
Do you define safety within this context?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what is safety in this context?
Imagine you have an AI which is driving your car for you. Okay, it's been tested in most of the scenarios and it's 99% accurate. But imagine the engineering team has not done their due diligence. And so somehow, at some point, the AI received an image which is triggering a numerical anomaly and your car suddenly turns into a wall. Boom, end of you. So that's a risk we cannot afford. And so we need to develop systems for a more for safer neural networks. And there are ways to do that. I just talked last week with a company called Themis AI. They develop a way for you to wrap your AI model into another model, which will handle black swan events like this. So that guarantees you that when you have your model is internally going through a black swan event, so there is going to spit out something completely absurd, putting people at risk, you can prevent that. You can detect it and you can prevent it, stop the car. You can have a recovery process started instead of just, you know, the car crashing into the wall.
No, fair enough, which in itself sounds almost like when you talked initially about AIs being brains, it almost sounds like a different cortex, right, in this sort of network of neurons that you're talking about. One for safety, one for productivity, one for... I liked what you said about it being a black swan event, right? Because it's basically you're saying it's a statistical anomaly that emerges out of the system that is net negative, right? Is this a number filter where you say the outcome of all these weights, the value that is being produced is so outside the normal distribution that we want to cut it off? So we only want to have normal distribution outcomes. If it's outside that, then we hit a recovery process. Our level of risk is like sort of increasing or reducing this window, right?
Yes.
Does that make sense? Like, is that sort of how these systems are doing it? Or is there a list of outcomes that we don't want, regardless of sort of any mathematical model that we explicitly see at this? If the model spits out this outcome, then we trigger this recovery process, right? So is it more general or specific?
It's kind of the generic idea, but it's more complicated than just a set of fixed rules. If you think about a self-driving car, the output is huge. It's humongous. And it's hard to, in real time, analyze that and detect that it's a wrong output. And similarly, if you take the example of ChatGPT, how do you know whether it's right or wrong? It's such an open space. You know, the ChatGPT AI can tell you a lot, an infinity of things. So you cannot really hard code. That's a good thing to say. That's not politically correct, or we don't want to expose. So it's complicated, and you need to actually use AI to catch AI errors. So interestingly, we are using AI to correcting AI.
Catch AI errors. What is sort of the idea behind that? So what is this parent AI doing with this? You know, does that make sense? Like,
so
what is that
I
doing?
Don't know for that specific company. I cannot talk for them, and I don't know about their IP. But
fair enough.
I can know about, I can tell you a little bit about, and it's an open area of research right now, honestly. So I don't know how OpenAI is doing their thing. I don't know how others or Google is doing it. They keep that recipe very secret internally. But the idea is that you would train an AI against each other. So you will have an AI trying to trick another one, and you would handle.
So
this, it's that kind of mechanism that are being used.
It's basically like an evolutionary mechanism. They evolve together until one is very good at defeating the other.
Yeah.
We've talked a little bit about AI safety. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the things that we want to look out for when we don't want AI to move in one direction, right? Mm-hmm. Specifically, we talked about your example was cars and making sure that it doesn't produce negative things. But one thing you talked about earlier was when we talk about having AI that just sort of generates false realities. And there is no set of outcomes that is now negative, and we want to prevent. We just, anything that it produces has the potential to be an issue, because the issue is in the perception of the person. So what do you think about that, and like sort of the issues around that? And so what are the things that we can do to manage that, right? I mean, there's an obvious, like, this is fake for sure, a sticker around every piece of, like, anything that's generated by AI or something. But as one might assume, that sticker can be removed, right? So that's like a sort of like a bad solution. Yeah. What do you, as someone who's big in this space, what do you think is at least the area good solutions can exist in?
Yeah, I don't think we should remove content unless that's really content that's dangerous for some population, like child pornography, stuff like that. You know, you have extreme stuff that you don't want. I am very much for free speech. I think that's the strength of this country. And I think that what Musk has been doing with Twitter, trying to reintroduce people, is actually a good thing. Even so, you might not like these people. I think everybody should have the right to say what they want to say and be heard if it's not offensive.
I
agree. So I think removing content is not a good idea, but I think transparency is important. The big danger with generated content and bots and things like that is that you can reinforce people into their opinion and expose them to content which is not realistic, but they will watch it anyway. And so you're going to reinforce division between people, isolate each person in their own little bubble of content they like, which is verifying their own their own biases and hypotheses. You know?
But do you think that they will still watch it if they knew it was fake? Do you think that people will go in that direction?
I don't know. I think at least we should be transparent. I think we should at least have a rule where we force content producers to mention whether this video was AI generated, whether it was enhanced, whether whether it's plain truth. And I think that would really, really help. Now, are you saying that people are still going to watch this content even so it's generated? Maybe. I don't know.
No, I think it depends on the content, but I think they will, right? I think they will watch it. I never thought about that, but I think that you saying that initially, I think that they would. I think it's a gradation, and that I think what you said about forcing people to identify that this is fake would be super important, right? Because it can be very insidious, sort of the insertion of artificial behavior, right? It could be it doesn't really have to be like a whole video that's fake. It could just be like, as I'm talking to you now, I say something that is wrong or inappropriate, and an AI does that part, right? Like as I'm talking right now, so an AI just does maybe the last 3 seconds and makes it seem like you're responding to something that is not what you're responding to, right? An AI could do that very easily. It doesn't have to be ostentatious. So, and then if you go to the bigger context where like everything is fake and whether people will be happy that this is fake or not, I think there are some things they absolutely don't care if it's fake. there are some things. Now, I think the thing you were pointing out initially, whether or not they'd be willing to believe something that they know is fake, I don't know. But I think somebody will figure out a way to make that somewhat true. It's just, I don't know how, right? But there are many people that believe things, like people who believe that Earth is flat, right? Yeah. In order to believe that, you really have to go out of your way. Mm-hmm. It takes quite a lot of work to believe that the Earth is flat.
Yeah.
In fact, if you did that work to that degree, you may as well understand the basics of astronomy. It's an interesting idea. Like the human behavior is very variable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting.
Yeah. It's a very interesting question. I think there is the question of just the truth of facts and information. And yeah, there may be people will be willing to at least see the problem and have a discussion about whether our president has said that or did not say that. We have a video out there with our president saying he will take all the guns of all the people in America.
Right.
And you might want to debate about whether it's false or not. But there are other types of content which are generated, which have a different type of impact, which is much more subtle, and which is mm-hmm. dangerous too. So there is a question of the truth of the fact. That's one. And I think a lot of people are mm-hmm. aware of that and see the risk that I mentioned of something really bad happening during the next election if we don't do something. But they are beyond the risk of a civil war, I hope not, but beyond the risk of that, there is just something that's happening right now, which is the fact that the reality we see through our screens is oftentimes very far from the reality of the real world. There have been countless studies about the relationship between social media and depression in young kids or in teenagers. And there is a correlation between the number of hours you spend every day on social media and your level of happiness. I think that's concerning. There is a huge issue beyond the political issue. There is another huge issue, which is that we live in a world where there is a huge incentive to gain access to people's brain time, right? So a lot of companies' business model in tech today are about how do I get people hooked so that they spend more time looking at ads? And in that context, there is a huge incentive to create catchy, fishy content, you know, the one that's going to get more views, right? And
right.
I think this is a very unhealthy game. And I'm afraid that with generative AI, it's going to just accelerate. A few psychologists are already trying to raise a flag. Since 2010, there is a huge increase in depression in young teenagers, and especially women, because they spend too much time on social media looking at unrealistic things.
Right.
And so it's dangerous, and there is a big lobby, obviously, and nobody's talking about it. But I think it's posing a threat to our society, and it's not helping with people having a realistic view of what the world is. It's like everybody's trapped into a digital prison, digital bubble, where you can feed them the content they want and get them to watch even more ads by getting them addicted to things which are not good for them. Like, how good is it for you to scroll all day?
Things that may not be net positive to you. I'll finish that sentence off. So first of all, the idea of things being artificially constructed to push you in one direction or another mm-hmm. has been happening for quite a while, right? People have been editing political campaign sort of speeches to give you one side of the story or a different side of the story for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
I think the media magnets have played into that mm-hmm. almost in a way that with a consensus, right? Mm-hmm. Almost where one will edit one will edit the other one, but no one will tell you that the other one was edited that this way or the other. And sort of cascade this news forward to rile you up and capture your attention. And the social media companies have almost, I would even say, done it a bit more authentically, where the social media companies will give you what you want that will definitely get your attention. And sort of the negativity in that is that it's absolutely, it works, it's how effectual it is actually. That's the problem. The problem with sugar is not that it's addicting per se, it's just that it gives you all the carbs you want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's any kind of absolute provisioning is mm-hmm. can be net negative.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good analogy.
So then when we think about those two things, then when we go through the other side, and then you talked about social media companies. What they do want, though, is your attention, right? Mm-hmm. And then you also already talked about the fact that people don't really care about authenticity that much per se. But I guess if you have a world where the kind of content you can produce, it's not even what other people are making. It's just, it can be manufactured just for you. Do you think that these social media companies are going to go in that direction where you're just going to go online and they're just going to generate what a reality for you that you said that you wanted?
You know, it's kind of happening. Like if I talk to my friend on the phone about, it was really interesting because I got married recently. And
congratulations.
I was talking about that with friends and suddenly I started receiving all these ads about wedding dresses and rings and stuff like that. And now I'm getting older.
Right.
Yeah. Do you want a baby? And all this baby ad stuff, you know. So they're all kind of different medium. And maybe content is already definitely tailored for each person. And and based on which ad you would click or look at longer, of course you will get tailored content. So that's really dangerous. I think, again, I would rather not have tailored ad for myself. I think that's not good.
So when I think about it, do you think it would be wrong for them? Let's say, because I think the tailored ad thing is, so that's one side of it, right? Mm-hmm. But would you think it would be, like, let's say they decided that, you know, you're watching some sort of series of things. Mm-hmm. Because now the way that they can do this would be crazy now, right? Because they could just say, you know, you're watching a bunch of things, right? So, for example, you just said baby ads. You said that has to do with, like, being married or, like, wedding stuff, right? Right? But they could just generate generate something that's just a combination of all three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they won't have to actually make an ad. They could just generate something that is a combination of all three. And so they could even have it so that the service of the advert itself would be an augmented service.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Do you consider that insidious or do you consider that an improvement in marketing technology?
No, I think our marketing technologies are far too good. I think we should not improve them anymore.
So it's almost the same thing with the sugar where it's like, it's not that sugar is bad. It's just like to have that level of accuracy for what you want is net negative simply because of its quality. It's like everything is just nuclear powered basically, mm-hmm. right? Like nuclear is not bad. It's just like it's all at once. So it blows everything up. AI is not bad. It's just all at once. It just makes it so everybody's everything is human understanding is obsolete. And the market, you know, it's just everything is overpowered mm-hmm. or has the potential to be overpowered to the way that like our physiology can't cope with it. It seems like.
Yeah, we are playing around with very powerful tools. Yes.
Very powerful tools.
Yeah, it's really accelerating. I don't think when I grew up, I don't think I thought a lot about how technology was governing my world. I felt really, really free. Like I would, you know, I had no cell phone growing up. Yeah. I would just, if I wanted to see my friend, I had to walk 1 mile and we would like take two horses and go ride in the countryside or whatever.
Two horses?
Anyway.
That's nice. You lived in the 1800s?
Whatever. Or we would whatever.
Two horses. That's cool.
But, The point is it's funny. The point here is that we have so much developed technologies to sell stuff better and get people to buy things they don't need that you know, it's mm-hmm. becoming we are all really manipulated. So we have to be careful about how we are manipulated. I think we need to give people back their freedom of decision and thinking. And the way we are more and more hooking people to an online world and trapping them into a bubble where they interact with their friends and people through digital medium all the time is concerning. I think a video conference like we do is totally fine. When all the content that's being presented to you has been tailored for you and all the contacts you meet are people who think like you, I don't know if that's really healthy.
There's so many problems. And so you bring it, which you do a great job of sort of bringing up like all these areas that even though some of the questions I'm asking are just sort of derivative of sort of what you're saying. I'm thinking, wow, this can be in this area, this can be in this area, and this could be a problem. But going back to what you talked about, which is at the foundation of all this in terms of solutions is ethics, right? Okay. So we talked a little bit about ethics. And one of the things we need to think about is like lawyers, we need to have ethics in engineering. And another problem, though, with that is now that with the disintegration of formal education systems, the pipeline for knowledge has now been is now distributed as well. So there is that issue there. But you know, let's make an assumption that we have the ability to interface all interactions with the ability to software skills with some sort of ethical understanding, whether it's mandated or not, in this sort of a new world where the only pipeline to knowledge is not universities. Mm-hmm. How would you go about that? Mm-hmm. What do you think is the foundational thing? I think you sort of insinuated it a little bit, which is establishing authenticity. What's your idea of sort of how to, even with that being sort of the goal, what do you think are some of the ways we can make that happen? Like, how do we incentivize ethical thinking within the system we currently have, right? Because we can't, if we do the legislation, it would be there because we enforced it. But then, as we talked about earlier, it'll be too late by the time we need it, right? Mm-hmm. Because legislation reacts to problems that happen. And this is one of those problems that when it happens, mm-hmm. it's going to be too bad.
Right.
It might destroy society before society can react.
Right. So I think it's, again, a multifaceted solution. So yes, there is a legal aspect of things. That's not sufficient. Then I think education is super important. So there should be an ethical class in every single computer science course. You should know.
Right.
And then there is just the fact of holding people accountable, asking them questions, making them feel that they are responsible for what they are doing. I do not think that the majority of developers at Meta are evil. I don't think so. I think they are great people and smart people, and they might, well, I should not take Meta as a company, but you know, a company publishing content, maybe, and pushing ads on people. Maybe they do not realize. You know, in my interviews, I told you I always ask that question. Tell me about a time when you have declined an opportunity for ethical reasons. And 90%, mm-hmm. sadly, 90% of the people answer, I've never thought about it. It's impossible. You're 30, 40. So, like, you have to have one time in your career had a situation when you had to say, no, I don't want to do that job. No, I'm not going to take the higher paying offer. I'm going to take that offer because it's a way to use my skills for good rather than. But oftentimes it's like, oh, I'm just developing a database, or, you know, it's not my fault. Like, I'm just a database engineer, you know, I'm just working on an AI to enhance the quality of ads. It's not my fault. It's not my problem, right? Yeah. I'm just doing my thing. But that's a very dangerous way of thinking. I think, okay, we are reaching the point, going out of the discussion. You know, the guy who drove the train to bring Jews to a concentration camp was just driving the train, right?
Yeah.
It's the same thing when you say, I'm just a database engineer. No, you're accountable. And I think that's very, when you realize that you are accountable, even if you're just developing the database of that big thing, I think that's a powerful start. If people start to be aware of what they are doing and feeling accountable for it, like we see for global warming, I think it's kind of working after years and years of information. Young people start.
40, 50 years.
Yeah. I think people
start. It took a long time. They've been doing it since the 70s. And finally, we have one product that considers it, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think for global warming, it's kind of working. Mm-hmm. We have shown that when people are really educated about the topic, well, they start saying no and feeling responsible. They triage their trash and they buy electric cars rather than another car.
Right.
Not everybody does it, but most of people now are trying to reduce their environmental footprint. Similarly for AI and ethics, I think if we promote ethical, responsible AI practices, invest into tools for making that easy and make it transparent that there are practices that should not be tolerated or are dangerous, I think that the field is going to change. So that, at least I'm hoping that.
Well, you know what? It was great talking to you today. Honestly, it was very informative. It brought up a lot of questions, even more than we talked before. Mm-hmm. And I thought we had a great conversation, but this one was just as thought-provoking and just as difficult to meander through. So, Kate, thank you so much. for coming on and teaching us a few things and sort of bringing out these ideas. And people want to reach out to you. I really do hope people listen to this and you know, take heed to it and really try and like pay attention to sort of the points you're making, because I think these are very hard to understand but very powerful points. And you know, if you're not in tech and you're listening, I think just really think about, you know, what's being said and just what is sort of the power of the tools that are being brought forward. But you know, if people want to reach out to you, ask more questions and get more clarity, like how do they find you? How are they going to be able to engage with you?
Ah, good question. Well, I think they can find me on LinkedIn. I'm not really on social media, as you could have guessed. So they can find me by my name on LinkedIn and drop me a message. I always appreciate when people want to just chat about AI and its possibilities and the risk associated. I would like to end with a positive note. I'm still working in AI and I have a lot of conviction about how it can transform society for the better. So it's the reason why I'm fighting so much against the risk associated with AI is so that we can keep using it to build a better world. All right. Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a wonderful conversation. You asked a really interesting question. As always, I'm with a lot of new ideas. So thank you very much. Have a really good day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.